Hello, and welcome to our next edition of Opus on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Gretchen Gondek, and delighted today to have Suzanne Hendricks-Case, mezzo-soprano, dramatic mezzo-soprano, in studio today for our weekly Opus feature. Hello there.
Hello.
Well, where to begin? I'm looking at your resume and your vitae. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about your education and your performance experience.
I actually grew up on a small farm just outside of Charles City, Iowa. So I'm a native Iowan. And I went to the University of Northern Iowa for a bachelor's in music education, which seemed like the practical thing to do. So that is probably why I made that choice. And fortunately, randomly was assigned to Jean McDonald for my voice teacher. And she is just one of the best voice teachers in the country. After having worked with lots of people, I still stand behind that it was complete fate that I was put there. I graduated. I taught elementary music for a year and was beginning to think it was not for me. And then they cut my position in my school district anyway. It was a small rural district and they needed to have some downsizing. And I thought, well, okay, this is a sign I should probably go back to graduate school, which is what I was planning. So I just went back to UNI. I originally started a degree in musicology, but then switched back over and finished my master's in voice instead. And at that point, thinking definitely that my plan was to teach, and my voice hadn't taken off in any kind of conspicuous way at that point. So I kind of cast several nets at assorted schools and ended up at University of Missouri in Kansas City, where I studied with Anne Delaney, who was a dramatic soprano. So when she heard me, she understood the big voice thing that teachers at other schools did not understand. So it was definitely the right fit. And right after I started studying in Kansas City, that first summer, I did the Des Moines Metro Opera Young Artist Program, where they bring 40 young singers from all over the country to be apprentice artists in the summer. And I was really lucky that second summer in grad school, during my doctorate, somehow I ended up in the San Francisco Opera Young Artist Program the summer right after Des Moines. And then that third summer, I was on stage at San Francisco Opera singing one of the Valkyries in Die Walküre. So I went kind of very quickly from, oh, I'm going to teach. Maybe I should get a little bit of experience to, okay, I'm making my professional debut at a major international opera house, which was completely unexpected.
You mentioned Charles City. Well, mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I grew up in Northwood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think played against you in football and basketball.
That's a possibility, and I wouldn't have paid any attention. I was in the marching band, and I went to the games, and I left after halftime. So,
did you always want to be a singer, Suzanne?
That is kind of a funny story, actually. Because I played French horn, the band in Charles City was very, very strong. And so I started playing French horn in fourth grade. And I remember in sixth grade, I went up to Mr. Bourne, my band teacher, and I said, I want to do your job when I grow up. And he said, okay, we'll take piano lessons, which I didn't start until a little too late. But my family was really good. We had a, much like the Chamber Music Association here, we had a group that would bring in solos or small chamber groups to Charles City at the time. And they had the Dallas Brass come in. So we went and listened to that. And they had a tape, which we picked up and found out it was one of the few things everyone in the family could agree to listen to in the car. So we listened to lots of brass classical, ending up being Baroque because trumpet Baroque somehow seems to be easy. It was easy to find at the time, music. And so one day at lunch, farm lunch, sitting there flipping stations on the television, we came across Wynton Marsalis, who we knew who that was, on public television in a documentary. And we said, oh, well, let's leave that on because that's a trumpet and that's something we can all agree to watch. So we're watching that, and all of a sudden the soprano, who now I know is Kathleen Battle, was singing with him. And I thought, oh, well, that's kind of strange. That lady is singing unlike anyone I had ever heard before. I knew opera existed, but I didn't know much about it. And that would have been about ninth grade, I think, at that point. And I ended up asking for still interested mostly in the trumpet, the instrumental aspect, but I ended up asking for the recording. The Baroque Duet was the album that the documentary was about. I asked for that for Christmas. My cousin was in college for a piano performance, said, oh, that's fun. My little cousin wants this. I'll give this to her for Christmas. And one day I was on my way to a 4-H meeting in the car listening to the recording with my mom. And I said, she gets paid to sing. And my mom said, well, yeah, some people do. I guess Louis, who was this farmer at my church, Louis had voice lessons, so I guess that's something normal people do. Should we try and get you voice lessons? And I said, yeah, that might be sort of interesting. And that is, it's a very strange way to back into a singing career, I think. That was how it happened, yeah.
I love Kathleen Battle. Her diction is so amazing. But I also love Janet Baker. In fact, many years that I worked here, I would read the back of the record jackets when we played LPs, and loved reading about her. But I guess I'd have to characterize the mezzo voice as just very velvety.
Yes, actually, back when I considered myself a French horn player, I remember somebody saying they thought the three most attractive timbres would be French horn, an alto woman's voice, which classically is usually translated into a mezzo-soprano. Could be a contralto. There are very few of those. Some people think I am one. I'm someplace in between. And then also a cello. So I would say those three instruments you could kind of compare vocally. Yeah, a soprano's voice. There are many types of sopranos, but especially the Kathleen Battle type is much lighter, clearer, where there is a certain darkness to the mezzo sound.
So explain for our listeners, if we categorize voices, talk a little bit about what a mezzo-soprano is. And I know that you mentioned different ranges, and I love the analogy. There is a certain kind of dark something in there, but it's a really unique sound. So talk a little bit about mezzo.
Yeah, I think most people are very familiar with choir singing, with soprano, alto, tenor, bass. And that is a way you can start to learn about voice types. But when you are discussing specifically classical singing, like opera, which is what I primarily do, things become more specialized and therefore more confusing. They have the German Fach system, which is named for Bach, the man who created it. And in that system are a wide variety of voice types. Highest would be the female soprano voice, and the lowest would be the male bass voice. For women, the main three categories would be soprano, mezzo-soprano, and contralto. And for men, countertenor is starting to become significantly more prevalent, and their range aligns closely with a mezzo-soprano's. But countertenor, tenor, baritone, bass baritone, and bass are sort of the big categories for men. And there is more with men overlap in the roles they would perform across those groups than for the women. Sopranos, I don't know the exact number, but there are probably something like 20 different types of sopranos. Mezzos, it's a little bit easier. You would have a lyric mezzo. You could even have a lyric coloratura mezzo, who is somebody who would sing a lot of Rossini roles. So the voice would be smaller, clearer, more similar to a soprano's voice, and move very quickly. The coloratura just means the voice moves. The lyric mezzo, verging into full lyric, would be more of your middle category. Light to middle, full lyric would be more middle category of mezzo, where the voice doesn't move as quickly, but can move, and also is just a little bit louder in volume. And then there's the last category of mezzo, which is where I am, which is a dramatic mezzo, which is basically the loudest, and also I would say sort of the thickest or darkest type of mezzo-soprano voice. And then you would have, beyond that, a contralto, who a contralto would have a darker voice than me, but would also could be anywhere on that volume spectrum. So classifying voices is sort of a twofold process where you're looking at the color of someone's voice, which frequently does happen to align with the range. So a clearer voice tends to be more comfortable singing higher. A darker voice tends to be more comfortable singing lower. But then you also have to take the size of the voice into consideration.
Now, you mentioned a dramatic mezzo-soprano. Is that, and the volume, and is that through training? Or is that just a characteristic of being a dramatic mezzo?
Certainly, having better technique will lead you to be more resonant and therefore carry further in a hall. If I use improper technique, I don't carry nearly as far as I do when I'm singing correctly. However, there are limits to everybody's physiology. And so I have lots of students who sing the exact same way that I do. But if they're a soprano, they might end up with a little tiny dingy ding, fast-moving soprano voice, and I've got a big black Mack truck of a voice. And that's just the way we're built, naturally, as people, even if we're using the exact same vocal technique.
I'm thinking of repertoire, and given what you've said, different ranges, like the Sea Pictures by Elgar, or some of the Brahms, the piece for mezzo-soprano and orchestra. Mm-hmm. So are those in your repertoire?
The Elgar, I have certainly sung some of the Sea Pictures. I've never done the entire set, possibly because Where the Corals Lie is definitely not my favorite song. I may have on purpose ignored those, but yes. But Brahms has been one of my favorite things to sing forever, because that really dark, thick quality is exactly what you need to make his pieces work. And it makes it very easy for me to sing those because they're really idiomatic for that heavy, dark, yeah.
So. And you have brought some examples, which we're going to play mm-hmm. as we go through the program. Do you want to talk a little bit about the first piece we're going to hear?
The first piece I included was A Mon Fils, which is from Le Prophet by Meyerbeer. And it is often considered a contralto role, although the range is high. That particular aria does go up to a B flat, which, if you're familiar with women's singing ranges, for a mezzo is about as high as it gets. That one doesn't have a long sustained B flat. It's just kind of a flip above the staff. And then it goes all the way down more than about 2.5 octaves below that to an F. So it really does show the entirety of the range. That piece is sung by a mother to her son who has just given up his fiance, so she would be released from captivity. So the mother is saying, thank you, son, for giving these people your fiancé, because now I am free. Most of my repertoire is old women, which that happens to be, witches. A lot of mezzo sing pants roles, men's roles. I am not that type of mezzo. But I do sing old women, witches, nurses, and a lot of things about dying. A lot of things about dying.
Well, let's listen to this aria now. A Mon Fils from Le Prophet. And here is Suzanne Hendricks Case.
Thank you.
And we're back with Suzanne and a performance of a work from Le Prophète, Meyerbeer's Le Prophète, A Mon Fils. My goodness, you do have, I mean this in the most complimentary way, a very big voice. I mean, beautiful. And this is from, this is not a recent recording.
No, actually, I don't have very many recent recordings because mostly I have been singing out on the road with actual opera companies with union orchestras. And so it is difficult, actually, to get recordings. All of these recordings are from my time during my doctorate at UMKC. So the most recent one is going to be from 2011, but I believe that last recording was from 2010.
We were talking a little bit during the musical part of the show about how the voice grows, and you were explaining to me about hitting your peak as a mezzo-soprano.
Right. In general, as a voice is larger or darker, it takes longer for that singer's voice to mature. So for a light lyric coloratura soprano, she better be ready to have her career at 22. Because that is when her voice will hit. For a dramatic mezzo like me, that age becomes 35. So there is a big difference as far as when the muscles get to be strong enough. If you have a bigger voice, the muscles must be a lot stronger than if you have a small voice. But even though up front it can be very frustrating to watch all of your soprano friends going off and working, in the end, I'm going to have an extra 15 to 20 years of longevity at the tail end of my career that the sopranos won't have, because the later your voice matures, also the longer it can last in terms of a career.
And is it also true that there are particular pieces of repertoire that you should do earlier rather than later? Is it true to say that you have to grow into some of these?
I really believe for lyric voices in particular that that is true. So for that kind of middle voice category, they will somewhere around 40 probably end up just most of the time getting a little bit darker and a little bit heavier. And sometimes those full lyrics can start to sing some of the smaller dramatic roles, or sopranos especially can go into the spinto repertoire when they get towards the end of their career. If you have a true dramatic voice, such as mine, although people do not want to hear you singing dramatic repertoire in your youth, it will not hurt you to study it. So if you, my only option is dramatic repertoire. Never do I audition for somebody and they say, she should be singing smaller stuff. It's so, while I really couldn't go out in my 20s and use the things that were appropriate for me to sing, it would not have hurt me to study them in the studio with my voice teacher at that age. Erda, honestly, the aria that I sing the most frequently in auditions, and I've covered it at Seattle Opera, that role, that would not have hurt me to sing that in high school. It's actually not, the range is fairly moderate. The rhythms are not terribly complex. It's just that nobody's voice has the actual weight and size to sound appropriate in that repertoire at that age.
Well, let's take a little different angle on our conversation now, Suzanne. You have, I'm looking at several of your performances and operas from the Vienna State Opera, Frankfurt Opera, several operas in the United States. And this Sunday, you're going to be performing. It's part of the Sioux City Chamber Music Association. Let's talk about that. That is at 3:00 at First Presbyterian Church here in Sioux City.
Mary Day, who helps to organize the series, I was really excited when she came to me last spring and said, hey, could you do a recital? Because I actually have not done a recital since 2011, when I was, or might have been earlier than that even, when I was finishing up my doctorate. And preparing a recital is very different than preparing for an opera, because in an opera, sometimes I go and I sing four lines and then I'm in a bunch of ensembles and that's it. With a recital, it's all you, but you get to pick whatever you want. So I'm really excited for this particular recital because I said, I'm going to sing all the music I always wanted to sing and never could because no one can stop me. So the first thing I'll be singing will be Ombra Mai Fu, which is Handel's Largo, which turns up frequently in movies and is very familiar actually to most people. Then I'm going into a Brahms set because Brahms is one of the earliest, I think, things that really resonated with me as a singer. My sophomore year in college, I sang one of the pieces that's on the program and I said, I have to learn how to sing so I can make this sound right. And that was a major turning point for me technically. And then I'll be singing a Duparc set, who I would say is sort of the Wagner of French repertoire. One of the pieces actually he wrote in response to critics who were using Wagnerism as a slur. And he said, fine, I'll show you. And he wrote an entire song on purpose to sound like Wagner. So that one's included. Also another song that is included, one of his most famous songs, he actually wrote while he was defending Paris from a siege by the Prussian army. He was in the barracks, which I thought that was really interesting when I learned that. In the second half, we will be doing Berg's Sieben Frühe Lieder, which are not done often. He was part of the Second Viennese School and was one of the three main atonal composers in the early part of the 20th century. And these pieces are early in his output, so they're basically just highly chromatic, late Romantic works. Those Berg pieces are stunning, and I've wanted to do them for years. And then we're ending with an Oberdorf set, which is something that's new to me. I don't normally sing in Spanish, but the music is really varied in that set, from some things that are just kind of short and sassy to some others, like Del Cabello Más Sutil is one of his most famous pieces, which is very... It's a simple melody, but set over sort of a harp-like accompaniment in the piano, and it's been fun to learn about Spanish music.
Well, as I look at your opera performances, the first thing that comes to mind is a tremendous range of operas here, but also that these are some really fun and interesting roles, like you articulated earlier, kind of more character roles.
Yes, definitely. It's not... My voice is not the sweet young thing, and I am fine with that because I think I would be incredibly bored singing the sweet young thing.
And from Sioux City Chamber Music Association, I see, well, this is really interesting to me. You're going to be in the Verdi Requiem performing with the Grand Rapids Symphony.
Yes, in November. And I have done it before with a small community choir, but this is my first time with a real symphony, and it was interesting. I got online and I looked at the other soloists, and it's kind of an intimidating group, so it's going to be a fantastic performance. I'm really looking forward to that, and the music from that really will kick you in the pants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I see you're going to perform with the Hawaii Opera Theater. That's a tough gig. And then you're off to Santa Fe. So tell us a little bit about those roles.
Hawaii Opera Theater will be my first time singing Filipievna in Eugene Onegin. I was lucky enough in 2015, do the math here, to sing in Eugene Onegin at Vienna State Opera, but I sang Larina, which there are actually, oddly enough, three roles in Onegin that I could sing, which does not happen very often. Normally, I'm lucky if there's one role in an opera that's appropriate for me. I don't normally sing Olga. I don't necessarily see that in my future, but Larina is the mother, Filipievna is the maid, and Filipievna is just enough lower that typically that's the one people hear me in. So I'm excited to finally get that one on my resume. Even though Larina was a great role, the Filipievna's a little more suitable, just a little bit longer. So I'm excited for that. I enjoy singing Russian music, even though I can't read Cyrillic, so I really need to get on that. Fortunately, some people have already transliterated everything into a phonetic alphabet, and that is very helpful. You get a good Bolshoi recording, and then you're set. This summer, I'm going back to Santa Fe. I spent 2 summers there as an apprentice artist, which was a fantastic opportunity. The second summer, I was able to sing the fortune teller in Arabella, so that was great to just get a nice little role, and that was fun. And now I'm going back, and I'm singing Zulma in L'Italiana in Alghieri, which is Rossini, which is something I don't frequently sing much as Rossini. And it's interesting because I sang a Rossini Stabat Mater earlier this season, so somehow he's following me around this season, which... we're not always the best of friends, but this particular role is fine for me, so I'm looking forward to it because Santa Fe is a great company, and I love working there. And I'm also going to be the understudy for the old lady in Candide, which is a fantastic show and a fantastic role, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, let's listen to another one of your recordings. Do you want to introduce this next piece from Handel?
Yes, this Handel aria is from Giulio Cesare. It's Priva son d'ogni conforto. And this one is where Cornelia, who is the wife of a big war general, the opera opens with her being there and she's in the court with Caesar and Cleopatra. And Caesar is presented with her husband's head in a box. And then she is abducted by the people who have killed her husband. And he wants to marry her, of course, like Cornelia. If someone chopped off my husband's head, I would not want to marry him. And so she is in the dungeon crying. She's tried to kill herself, but they have prevented her from doing that. So this aria is basically, I am so sad, I can't even kill myself.
Thank you.
the voice of mezzo Suzanne Hendricks Case, performing music from Julius Caesar by George Frideric Handel. Wondering how you strike a balance between a very active and vigorous schedule for performances with teaching, which you clearly love doing. I see all kinds of teaching experience here. How do you balance that?
That's a good question. I'm learning how to do that. When I took this job here at Morningside, last year was my first year, and I already had a couple of jobs lined up in advance. And so they were kind enough to let me wrap those up. So I actually came here last year. I taught for a week, and then I went to Chicago for 7 weeks. And I covered a role there, and I'm trying to avoid keeping that from happening again. This spring, when I go to Hawaii, that's 3.5 weeks, which is much more manageable, because then I can just double up on voice lessons with my students. I'm fortunate that most of what I do is studio voice, which is one student at a time. And so we can be a little bit more flexible with rescheduling lessons so I can make sure everyone's covered. I also am thinking, because thankfully there is a big time difference between here and Hawaii, that I'll probably be able to teach some of my diction courses via Skype or Zoom, something like that, over the internet while I'm in Hawaii. So that should help keep things rolling that way next semester.
And about how many students are you working with this semester?
This semester, I'm teaching an extra course that's not normally in my load. So my numbers are down a little bit. I've got 8 students. But last spring, I had 13, which is a little bit more of a normal load, plus then either vocal pedagogy or diction, depending on the year.
As you look forward to your career, where do you want to be 5 years and 10 years from now? Or is that too much of a daunting question?
Yes. I've learned as a performer, it's pretty difficult to say, I'm going to do this in 5 years or 10 years, because the career definitely has its own path for you. But honestly, and it seems very strange after years of constantly feeling like I'm on a treadmill, to say, I think this is pretty much, this year is a fairly good representation of what I would like to continue doing, actually, which is sort of nice to say. But the balance between, I miss teaching when I'm singing, because I really do, I think teaching is very important, especially working with music education majors, because if we're not teaching the college students to go out into the public schools and teach it, where's the audience for all this stuff going to come from? And so I really enjoy working with college students and teaching, but it's nice to get out and, you know, do the Verdi Requiem here and a Rossini Stabat Mater there. And if Santa Fe, I'm happy to go back there any summer they want.
Or Hawaii.
Yeah. Or that's fine too. That's okay. I'll take Honolulu's not bad.
So for our listeners, and for myself, can you explain how the audition process works? I mean, how do these other opera companies all over the world know about you?
I have an agent, and that is very helpful. I am very, very bad at self-promotion. I will say that myself. I think it's the Midwestern Iowa nice thing where I don't get into a situation and I don't like to walk up in front of people's faces and say, hi, I'm the best mezzo you've ever heard, because that's annoying. So I have an agent, and he talks to the opera companies when they release their upcoming, these are the operas we're doing in 2019. He says, okay, these are all the singers I have that would fit these possible roles. And then he gets to work on that. And sometimes I need to go audition for companies and sometimes not. Less and less I'm having to audition, because a lot of these companies I've already worked for them. So if I've already worked for them, they kind of know what I can do. They'll say, oh yeah, for instance, Santa Fe, I thought I was singing for them a couple years ago, and then the timing didn't work out. And then I got this job anyway, coming up the summer, because I was there 2 summers as an apprentice. So they were familiar with me. Then sometimes you do random auditions. Literally 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I was in New York and I sang for the Met, because they have had some kind of turnover with people retiring and that sort of, you know, nothing dramatic, just retirement. So there's new people on board. And it was just kind of a, hi, let me sing for you now sort of audition. And I wasn't singing for anything in particular. And hopefully I made a good impression and they'll remember me when they need me down the road in their casting. And so my agent will set those kind of things up. Sometimes it's for a specific role, but most of the time it's just these introductory type of things. So when something turns up, he can work me in.
And then he makes all the arrangements. So basically you just get your plane ticket, go to the gig and come back. Is it like that?
I have to make all of my own housing arrangements, lots of opera companies, especially San Francisco. I've worked there a few times. They have one of the best, I think, departments as far as helping you line up an apartment, helping you line up your plane tickets. They're really, really excellent at San Francisco Opera. And other companies always have somebody. This is the person to get in touch with when you're booking this. And so it's a little bit different with every company. But yeah, my agent sets up the jobs, gets the contract signed, and offers you a certain amount of, you know, if something's not working out right, which fortunately I've never had to use my agent in this capacity, but I could always call and say, hey, I'm at this company and they haven't done X, Y, and Z. And then he can follow up and try to make sure that I'm taken care of, which fortunately, like I said, I've never had an opera company where that's been an issue. But.
And then there is, I would assume, a pretty rigorous rehearsal schedule when you arrive to do the role.
Fortunately, most of the opera companies I'm working at are in AGMA, which is our union, which they limit our rehearsals to 6 hours a day, which doesn't sound that much, except I will say being in an opera is very much like being in school. So you're on your feet, you're learning something new, and when you're there, your brain is working that entire 6 hours. And then frequently, you're in rehearsal that 6 hours, then you go home and you have to resort your brain, all of the things that you changed in rehearsal, relook at all your blocking, everything you've done, and then potentially you need to keep working on whatever the next gig is too. So even though your rehearsal might be 6 hours a day, while you're on that job, you're working significantly more because you're working in advance of all your other jobs. Because when you have an opera job, you have to show up totally memorized, totally coached, knowing all of your music, ready to go. There's no get there and learn it.
Well, you're reprising a lot of roles that you've mm-hmm. done, but when you have a new role, what is your methodology for research and preparation?
More haphazard than it should be. I always start with the translations, pretty much. I get my score out. I highlight my parts. I translate everything. I translate the things I'm not singing, so I know what people are saying around me or to me or about me, that sort of thing. And I also double check for any diction abnormalities because as speakers of English, we should know there's lots of exceptions to every pronunciation rule. And English is worse than most languages. But I'm teaching Italian diction right now and I'm teaching the kids constantly. Look it up. Is that a stressed E or an O? Look it up. What's that final E or O do? Look it up. And so spend a lot of time sorting through that. And then sitting down, speaking through the roles, and then learning the pitches on some kind of neutral syllable. So learning words with the pitches can be very tricky and problematic for a variety of reasons. So get it so I can speak things fluently and then sing them and then put it together. And then at that point, taking it to a coach where the coach then will play it. You'll sing for them. They correct music, diction, that sort of thing. If I don't run into this much anymore because I had an excellent voice teacher, but if there is something especially strange or problematic in the role, I will also take it for a voice lesson because a voice coach and a voice teacher are two very different things with different functions. So for vocal issues, you go to your voice teacher, and for music related, make it sound more stylistically appropriate issues, you take it to your coach. So you go through all of that, look up any historical things that might be pertinent, you know, and become educated that way. And then hopefully you're all ready to go on that first day of rehearsal.
And then talk a little bit about makeup and costuming.
That's always fun. And yeah, I'll never forget the first time I really worked with San Francisco Opera, the costume shop there. It was for the Valkyrie. They had us in jumpsuits, cotton jumpsuits, which just looked like they must be the least flattering things on the planet. And they had my measurements from the summer before. And I went for my first fitting and they put me in the jumpsuit and they took in each hip half an inch and it fit perfectly and it was flattering. And I thought, these people know what they're doing. So if you're in a new production or if the person before you was a radically different size, then you have that luxury of people making things specifically just for you, which is fantastic. Sometimes in a remount, you'll get clothes that are a little odd and cobbled together, but if it looks good from 20 feet away, that's fine. And I'm at the point now, fortunately, since I'm not a young artist anymore, where people mostly always do my hair and makeup for me. But as a young artist, you spend a lot of time in those summer programs when you're in the chorus, putting on the makeup yourself, and you learn. And lots of times still for oratorio jobs, you'll be in charge of your own hair and makeup, which is something I'm still learning to be comfortable with.
But. Well, I'm switching gears on you. What are you wearing for the Verdi Requiem? And how do you decide when you do a concert rather than an opera? Like, what's the thinking behind that?
You need an army of evening gowns. And so, fortunately, my house here in Sioux City has a lovely, generous closet in the basement where I can store all those things. And for a Requiem, I am wearing a navy dress, so hopefully that will be okay. Sometimes, it's not in my contract, you want to check. It should be specified if I need black. Sometimes for Requiems, they want black. But sometimes you work with a conductor that says, that's too boring, wear a color. So you sort of need to know. You also need to know, do your shoulders need to be covered or not? Which for a Requiem, that's always a little bit safer. So I've got a navy dress with a cap sleeve and minimal embellishments. Now, I did the International Wagner competition in Seattle a few years ago, and I thought, I need a major dress for this. So I had a full skirt, purple, duochrome, so kind of a purple-blue kind of taffeta situation going on.
Well, of course.
Yes, and it really popped in the light, and that was fantastic. But for a text as somber as the Requiem, it doesn't seem entirely appropriate.
Well, I'm just thinking probably understated is best,
yes,
for something
exactly
like that. Why don't we listen to, and I love this, the Chanson Médicace. You want to introduce the next piece by Ravel?
Yes, Ravel wrote a trio of pieces, the Chanson Médicace, and this will be the first one, Nandove, from that set.
Thank you.
Well, let's hear one more piece of music. This is the last offering we're going to have on our program today. Suzanne, do you want to introduce it?
Oh, yes. I'm trying to even remember what it is. Yes, this last one will be Le Manoir de Rosamond by Duparc. And actually, I will be singing this one Sunday.